Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
Don't need to talk. All we need to do is force Israel to respect international law and human rights.
It was all civilian houses that were destroyed by the borderline. All we can say is that the attacks keep happening.
We hear from Professor Mazen Kumsaya, author of Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle. His soon-to-be-released book is Hope and Empowerment, Civil Resistance in Palestine. First, Sarah Bailey of El Mezon Human Rights Center in Gaza comments on the report from South African judge Richard Goldstone, an international law expert who prosecuted war crimes in Rwanda. Israeli leaders have hired an attorney to address any legal claims that may stem from his report on civilian casualties in Gaza during Israeli Operation Cast Lead. El Mezon Center teamed up with the group Defense for Children International, and their comprehensive report is based on 43 case studies illustrating a vast range of violations they say were perpetrated by Israel, many of them deadly for children, including the destruction of schools, homes, and life-sustaining infrastructure such as water and sanitation networks, and the use of children as human shields, as well as the arbitrary detention of children. The El Mezon Center for Human Rights, along with Defense for Children International Palestine, also endorse recommendations put forward by the Goldstone Mission, including bringing Israel to the ICC, International Criminal Court, should the government of Israel fail to undertake timely, independent, and impartial investigations. Sarah Bailey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Why don't you start by giving us an overview of what's in the Goldstone Report? We've really not heard much about it in the U.S. press.
The Goldstone Report basically provides a legal analysis and a factual overview about the extent of violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law perpetrated in the Gaza Strip during Operation Cast Lead. It focuses heavily on specific incidents which are highlighted as being potential war crimes or even crimes against humanity which are perpetrated by the Israeli forces here. It does look at the statistics of the victims killed and basically confirms the accounts of several human rights organizations which document at least 1,400 total casualties, of whom around 80% were civilians. And those figures include 353 plus children.
NPR's Robert Siegel interviewed Judge Goldstone and then got reaction from Mark Regev, the spokesperson for the Israeli government.
I anticipated and haven't been taken at all by surprise by the criticism that comes from the Israeli government. But I would hope that many, many objective people and there are many of them in Israel, would see this in a different light and not see this in any way as being anti-Israel, in fact, to the contrary.
I don't want to make this personal, but let me make it clear. If he would have followed the leader of Mary Robinson and said, I refuse to have anything to do with this sort of kangaroo court, I would have more respect for him.
That sounded like more of a personal attack from the Israeli spokesperson, Mark Regev, than a real analysis of what's in the Goldstone report and a defense of Israel.
Goldstone is one of the most highly respected international legal experts around the world and has prosecuted war crimes in Rwanda and is sort of held in very high esteem by the UN and other international legal mechanisms, as well as independent experts. So, within the human rights community, it's been very well received as a extremely important document which provides an authoritative confirmation of the documentation that's already been produced by local Palestinian organizations such as Al Mizan, who I work for in Gaza, as well as the large international human rights organizations such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch.
Well, just looking at this report, 353 children killed during and in the aftermath of Israeli operations, 116 killed by drone attacks, 66 of them dying after Israeli forces obstructed medical access, and 7 children used as human shields by Israel, with 1 child detained for 10 days. 18 schools completely destroyed, displacing 10,500 children, and overall Israeli military actions resulting in the deaths of at least 623 children in the Gaza Strip. Sarah Bailey, these statistics are a very serious indictment of Israel.
Well, they are. I mean, the evidence that local organizations have been putting together, which, as I say, has been confirmed by the findings of the Goldstone report, really demonstrates that Israeli forces deliberately contravened international humanitarian law principles whilst in the Gaza Strip during Operation Cast Lead. To highlight one issue, the issue of the precision missiles, as the report illustrates, over 100 children were killed by attacks from unmanned aircraft, drone attacks, and a Human Rights Watch study demonstrates clearly that these missiles are able to view such a level of detail of targets as to be able to distinguish between children and adults and actually see the colour of people's clothes. In such a case where you have over 100 children killed by these types of missiles, there really seems to be no explanation for these attacks other than a deliberate killing. Israel has to investigate these incidents and provide some kind of explanation, which, you know, we believe is just really not possible given the evidence that we have.
What does the Goldstone report call for in response to the findings that are outlined here about children and other civilian casualties due to Operation Cast Lead?
The Goldstone report includes lots of very important recommendations, but it's really pressing for accountability. These crimes have been going on in the Gaza Strip and the occupied Palestinian territory for decades now, and Goldstone really highlights this in his report by calling unequivocally for Israel to investigate allegations of war crimes and the evidence of war crimes that he presents in his report. It goes on to recommend that if Israel fails to do so, then the international community has an obligation to act through various mechanisms, including by referring Israel, the situation in the Gaza Strip, to the International Criminal Court for possible prosecution following investigation, and also for countries around the world to use the mechanism of universal jurisdiction to prosecute suspected war criminals wherever they are. I think his fundamental point is that if Israel fails to investigate, and in Almizan's view, there have been no proper investigations involving due process and adhering to international legal standards on any of these issues in the last few decades. And I think the fundamental point is, if Israel doesn't finally investigate and prosecute these crimes, then the international community must step in and use all the legal mechanisms it has available to prosecute and hold war criminals accountable for their actions.
What about the U.S. response to the Goldstone report? In fact, we're hearing that the White House appears to have dropped its stern language about Israeli settlements.
I think the response in the United States from the officials there is extremely disappointing. And it seems so hypocritical. If you look at, for example, their decision not to veto the Security Council resolution referring the situation in Darfur to the ICC several years ago. By doing that, they were basically saying that perpetrators of heinous war crimes need to be held accountable. But at the end of the day, this principle doesn't seem to apply to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory. This situation has been going on for decades, and real measures in adherence to international law need to be taken. And that's obviously what we want to see from all states in the world, including the United States. It has a legal obligation to uphold these principles.
Well, is the U.S. necessary? Can other countries get together and call for a trial here at the ICC, International Criminal Court?
Well, at the end of the day, the Security Council will be required to refer, it will have to refer the situation here for investigation at the ICC or for the ICC to consider the issue. And if just one of the states on the Security Council, one of the permanent members, decides to veto any such move, then this whole quest for accountability, which ultimately is just a quest to stop these horrific crimes from happening and to protect civilians and to protect thousands and thousands of people from having their lives destroyed, you know, all states in the Security Council have the ability to do that, and we'll be really pressing for them to stop the hypocrisy and double standards in dealing with different countries across the world and to actually support international law in that regard.
I just want to read some of these headlines at Mazan.org, Al-Mazen Center for Human Rights. Three Israeli air raids on Gaza-Egypt border, missile attack at Salah ad-Din Gate, south of Rafah town. Missile fired at Block G, southwest of Rafah refugee camp. Tunnel bombarded in raid. Red Crescent finds casualties still inside. Some trapped. Israeli drone attacks at West Bayat Lahaya Beach. Two children injured by Israeli shelling at El Mosadar village, middle Gaza district. A two-story house destroyed. Twin children injured as they dressed for school. And it looks like ground troops moving into Gaza City after that artillery attack. Four attacks on the 30th, Wednesday. Israeli warplanes targeting Salah al-Din Gate, south of Rafah town. That is the border with Egypt, and also firing near the Rafah refugee camp.
Well, that's correct. And it's one of the things that the outside world just doesn't pick up on in terms of what's going on here. The attacks during Operation Cast Lead were of a massive scale, and so it was picked up by the international media. But there are regular attacks carried out against people in Gaza on a daily basis. Five children were kidnapped several weeks ago. A child was shot while near the borderline a couple of weeks ago. Fishers, farmers trying to farm their lands in the areas near the borderline with Israel are regularly attacked and shot by Israeli forces, you know, with no apparent military justification again, which constitutes further evidence of war crimes. These attacks are ongoing, and it's something that Al-Mizan is reporting on a regular basis.
Can you give us any insight as to why this is all happening right now?
We can't start to really explain why the Israelis are behaving in that way and why their military forces are carrying out these attacks. But we can say that the attacks are ongoing, and we can say that it's very difficult to see what possible military justification there is. In the report we just issued related to child rights violations, for example, we highlighted there was massive destruction of houses, civilian homes, near the Rafah borderline. And you hear justifications that this is related to trying to undermine Hamas targets, but it was all civilian houses that were destroyed by the borderline. All we can say is that the attacks keep happening, and, you know, it's very difficult to see what possible military justification there are for the attacks.
Sarah Bailey of the Al-Mizan Center, based in Gaza. Israel has said it engaged in the most recent air and land attacks in Gaza in retaliation for rocket attacks from Gaza. Israeli news sources have provided videos of people moving on the ground. Israel claims they were setting up rockets in Gaza. But the Israeli newspaper Haaretz has posted the films next to a report that states, quote, Gaza militants fired a Qassam rocket and several mortar shells into Israel following the airstrike, but caused no injuries or damage.
Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Harel on Saturday said he believed there would be several more rounds of fighting between Israel and Hamas.
That from Haaretz website, and it was JerusalemOnline.com news. The item aired after a commercial asking people to move into new homes in Bethlehem. Joining us next from Bethlehem is Professor Mazen B. Kamsaya. He teaches at Bethlehem and Beerzeit Universities, and he was born in Bethlehem. However, Professor Kamsaya received his higher education in Jordan and the U.S. He has U.S. citizenship. He was on the faculty of the University of Tennessee, Duke, and Yale University. Professor, just comment on what you know about Barack Obama, the president's remarks at the UN, and what they mean for Palestinians.
Well, I myself have not voted for Obama. I do have U.S. citizenship, and I encourage people not to vote for him because I didn't believe he was going to affect change. But a lot of Palestinians here in the West Bank, especially, have indicated that they were hopeful and they would support him and things like that. And I always thought that they are going to be disappointed at some point. And I think they have reached that point last week when Obama backed down on his demand for a freeze on the settlement activities. That was like the straw that broke the camel's back. And so I think many Palestinians have reached the conclusion that Obama is not going to affect any change in U.S. policy, and that U.S. policy remains solidly supportive of Israel and continues to fund Israeli aggression, basically.
The time has come to relaunch negotiations without preconditions that address the permanent status issues, security for Israelis and Palestinians.
U.S. President Barack Obama in September at the UN. Professor Mazen Kamsaya, what if the Israelis interpret this absence of preconditions to mean go ahead, build settlements, and they start to initiate a major wave of settlements? They're already building them.
Well, at this point, you know, there are 500,000 settlers living in the West Bank, including, of course, occupied East Jerusalem, which is part of the West Bank. These 500,000 settlers are anticipated to grow in the next 20 years to about 800,000 settlers. This land cannot sustain the kind of settlement activity that has been going on, even if the Palestinians, by some miracle, accept to be perpetually occupied, and they have been occupied at least in the West Bank since 1967 and in the remainder of Palestine since 1948. So I really think there's a big problem that's brewing, and that if we look at the violence and the resistance and the way the resistance builds up, this is just a natural law of physics. When you put people in situations where there's a pressure cooker, where their lands are confiscated every day, where they see their livelihood taken away, their water, their agricultural land, their ability to feed their children. You put 1.5 million people in Gaza, for example, you surround them with a fence in a piece of desert land, and most of them are refugees or displaced people. They can see even across the border, they can see the empty lands that they were kicked out from to create the State of Israel. These empty agricultural lands that are in Ashkelon, what Israel calls, and Sderot and those other places that they can see. And you can see why resistance develops, and you can see why resistance might escalate in the future. And you can see that fences, walls, and nuclear weapons and all of these things do not provide any kind of meaningful security. What provides real security is justice and equality. And this is the catastrophic, there's really only two roads, either one that leads to catastrophe. As Martin Luther King said, we either all live together as equals or we die together as fools in war. So basically we either have, you know, continue to kill each other or we recognize that there's a possibility for equality and demand that Israel implement international law and human rights, which have a better roadmap to peace than this one that they are trying to peddle.
What about President Barack Obama heading the UN Security Council? Does that raise your hopes at all?
I think the indicators are solidly behind the idea that the Obama administration does not provide the change in U.S. policy. And I think a good evidence of this you can find, for example, in the U.S. administration out-of-hand rejection of the U.N. Human Rights Commission report on the recent attacks on Gaza, where 1,400 Palestinians were killed, most of them men, women, and children, civilians, who had nothing to do with the fighting. And Israel has committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza using U.S. weapons, which is in violation of U.S. law, in addition to being in violation of international law. And the fact that Obama and Hillary Clinton and his representative at the United Nations, all three of them, made statements to the effect that they consider the report biased, even though it was issued by a Zionist from South Africa, who's a previous judge. This is something that tells us that, again, the U.S. is not going to pay attention to international law and human rights. And basically, it's a slap in the face of the United Nations and a slap in the face of international law and human rights. So it's a bad sign, and I am very skeptical that any change will be forthcoming. Obama speaks a very good line, but on practical matters, he still votes and acts as George W. Bush or any of them.
Your new book is Hope and Empowerment, Civil Resistance in Palestine, due out shortly from Pluto Press. Can you describe what you're getting at with this book? It's a history. You're also talking about some of the nonviolent ways people have resisted in Palestine historically.
Yes, the primary purpose of the book is actually directed to Palestinians to show us and show me, basically. I mean, most authors write books primarily to convince themselves of something, to show me and show the rest of the Palestinians that our history is inspiring. There is a lot of successful civil resistance that does not involve violence. And the beauty of civil resistance, it keeps our humanity. It keeps our common humanity. It allows us to retain this most beautiful aspect of our humanity, so that even if the conflict ends tomorrow, and I hope it does, but if it doesn't, it lasts another few years. One day it will end. And even when it ends, we cannot survive as a society if our liberation was built with violence and with destruction of another. Our liberation must be built based on our common humanity. And I think you see the difference between, for example, what happened in Algeria and in South Africa, where in Algeria, 1 million Algerians died in violent resistance. But even when the society did triumph and they did remove the colonizers, the violence remained endemic in the society because it was endemic in the resistance. And so I think that there would be less violent repercussions and less violent societies on all fronts. And I think Israel is the same way. If we look at the incidence of domestic violence, for example, in Israel, it's very high. That is directly related to the issues of the endemic nature of violence in Israeli society now. And we don't want to get to that stage. We want to diminish violence and show people that there is better ways of resistance than trying to get revenge and things like that.
You know, I can remember in January when Barack Obama first took office, Mustafa Barghouti writing and others writing that unless Palestinians could form a democratic collective leadership, they stood to lose a great deal. What do you think about that today?
Yes, I think one, of course, needs more unified leadership at some level, and we all hope for it and push for it. But also, we have to be realistic that in a diverse society like Palestinian society, or for that matter, Israeli or American societies, there's diversity of opinions, diversity of political factions, and so on. In South Africa under apartheid, there was also significant differences between groups like the African National Congress, the Communist Party, the Pan-African Congress, and so on. And they had different visions of where and how to achieve their ultimate goal of independence and equality for black people in South Africa. So I'm not as pessimistic as Mustafa Barghouti in looking at this and saying that they have to unify or we're not going to get anywhere. I think South Africa was able to get somewhere without a unity of leadership of black South Africans. There were more dominant ones, like the ANC was more dominant than other factions. But it does not mean that you have to have a unified leadership to achieve particular goals, especially when these goals are fully and 100% supported by international law and by basic human decency, like the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands, things like that.
Just explain what you've been writing about when it comes to pollution in Palestine.
Yes, and it affects both Palestinians and Israelis. This is the bizarre situation that we live here in, and essentially lived with it since Zionism was created. The idea of Zionism, of creating a Jewish state in this land and bringing in all the Jews from around the world and settling them here in a very small area at the expense of the native people, have created paradoxes that are affecting the livelihood of everybody here, including Israeli Jews and others. I mean, I'll just give you one simple example. Israel refuses to let Palestinians develop sewage treatment plants here in the West Bank, even though we have some funding, some donors like Japan and Europe willing to pay for these things. But Israel refuses to let us do that because they want to make life here so uncomfortable for us that we would leave. But of course, Palestinians are not leaving and they are producing sewage. And this sewage is running down the valleys and goes into the water aquifers. The water aquifers are ones underneath our land, underneath the West Bank, that Israel uses 80% of these waters. The Israeli public uses 80% of these waters. So here's the situation where Israel is willing to even poison and destroy its own sources of water for the sake of a politically expedient thing, which is to destroy livelihood for the Palestinians. And this is just one of hundreds of examples like this. The destruction of the commerce, the destruction of the economy, the destruction of the agriculture, the removal of 1.5 million trees that impacts obviously the climate and the weather here and the air that we all breathe, whether Israelis and Palestinians. These are things that the political echelons in Israel decide on based on the political ideology of Zionism, not based on logic or reason or even long-term interests of Israelis living here.
Professor Komsaya, if you could speak to Jewish and American leaders and to peace groups interested in human rights in both Palestine and Israel, what would your message be, especially now that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, is also heading the UN Security Council?
Well, I think the short-term interests of Zionism need to be looked at with a very careful examination versus what is really in the interest of people, whether Israelis, Palestinians, Americans who are footing the bill for all of this. And I think they need to look at it in terms of long-term. And long-term, this is not sustainable. An apartheid system has not succeeded. The French tried it in Algeria. The South African white minority tried it. Other, you know, the U.S. segregation tried it in the South. Segregation does not work. Apartheid does not work. Only justice brings peace and prosperity to all people, all the parties involved. And this is, I think, the main message that they need to hear, and they need to look at it. And there's scientific evidence that they can examine. There are facts that they can examine, documents on demography and population growth, water resources, environmental issues. These are all available, and we should set aside these antiquated notions of chosenness and racism, basically, and look at each other as human beings and that we all deserve a life. And we are all created equal, and so we should actually do that, just implement equality.
Of course, Martin Luther King ultimately deciding that it was relevant for Americans interested in racial conditions for African Americans to also talk about conditions for the Indochinese people that we were fighting. What about conditions for civilians in the Middle East? How relevant that we understand conditions for them and the interrelationship between our two worlds?
The reason we have such a poor U.S. economy and the U.S. dollar keeps going down is precisely because the Zionist movement has pushed for the war in Iraq, thinking that it's in the benefit of Israel. It is in the benefit of a few elite Israeli Zionists, but not certainly in the benefit of Israeli public. And yet they pushed for it, and they got it, and it was a disaster for everybody concerned. It was a disaster. First of all, for the Iraqis, 1.3 million Iraqis died since the U.S. invasion. And second, for the U.S. taxpayers and U.S. servicemen and women who died in Iraq, continue to die in Iraq and Afghanistan. And third, it was a disaster for the rest of the world community, for the Israelis and the Palestinians, and for the Europeans and others who are also getting significant backlash and significant problems because of this illegal invasion of Iraq that violated the United Nations Charter and other things. So that's why these things are all connected and why we certainly cannot speak for the freedom of the Palestinians without speaking for the freedom of the Iraqis and without speaking about the relationship of things like why the Zionists are now pushing for a war in Iran. I mean, the big brouhaha about Iran that is being cooked up in the United Nations is just a charade. It's laughable, almost, the kinds of statements that they're making about Iran, how reminiscent of what we heard about Iraq, weapons of mass destruction, dangerous regime, has to be changed, etc. This is all just, you know, banging the drums of war. And the American public and the Western publics are beginning to wake up to these realities.
Professor Mazen B. Komsaya teaches at Bethlehem and Beerzeit Universities. He joined us from Bethlehem. You can find his books at komsaya.org, KUMSIYEH.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program produced in Storrs, Connecticut, were syndicated with Pacifica. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Write to us at TalkNationRadio@gmail.com.